Services will come to order. We're going to start with a couple of work sessions, and the first one is HJR 11. Would you tell us about HJR 11?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. HJR 11 is a resolution the committee heard last week. It recognizes September 2007 as Alcohol and Drug Addiction Month, Recovery Month. The committee does have now before them a -1 amendment, which would take out 2007, so it would make every September Alcohol and Drug Addiction Recovery Month.
Okay, not a one-time
celebration.
Karen, would you come up, please, and identify yourself and tell us what we need to know.
Thank you, Chair Morissette. And for the record, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Addictions Policy Manager with the Addictions and Mental Health Division, part of DHS. I'm here to support House Joint Resolution 11 and the -1 amendments. I think it's great to have Recovery Month every year. And, in fact, the department has recognized Recovery Month for years now. And I would say that, fortunately for me, I get to work at a department where every day is Recovery Day. We hear about people who get into recovery, and we're part of that every single day. My only hope is that we can have more people get into recovery from addiction. The department has recognized efforts around the state. We've supported and co-sponsored events such as Hands Across the Bridge in Portland. The governor was there a couple years ago. It was very exciting. We had an event here in Salem last year, and we had about 300 people show up on Saturday here in Salem at Bush Park, and we actually held an event here in the Capitol in Room 50 a couple years ago. So we have really done a pretty nice job as far as states go in recognizing this. I would also say that addiction is a treatable and preventable disease. People can and do recover, and recovery is really the most invisible part of addiction. We see addiction, we see the ravage, we see things in the news, we've seen the faces of meth. Unfortunately, when people get into recovery, they sort of blend back into society. They get jobs. They become taxpayers. They raise their kids, or they get their kids back. So recovery is really invisible, and I just want to say definitely support House Joint Resolution 11 that would increase the visibility of recovery. So thank you, and I entertain any questions if you have any, or I'll talk later on.
Thank you. Any questions?
Nope.
No questions. Thank you very much, Karen. We will close. No, we're not going to close. We didn't. That wasn't a public hearing. That was just our work session, which is open. Do we have a motion for HJR 11?
With the -1s?
With the -1s.
Yep.
Yeah,
so moved.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendment to HJR 11.
Senator Cruz moves -1 amendments to HJR 11. Discussion? Seeing none, so moved.
Mr. Chair, I move HJR 11 as amended to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Okay.
Or as adopted, excuse me.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves HJR 11 as adopted as amended to the. Why are you making life complicated?
To
the floor of the Senate with a new pass recommendation. Would you call the roll, please? Thank you.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Aye. HJR 11 after a torturous. Hearing. Approval process passed, and I will carry. Okay, we are going to have a work session on House Bill 2242. Would you read the latest information that we have on
Thank that? You, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2242 is a bill the committee heard on April 11th. There was some concern that the language of the bill allowed licensure denial. The language of the bill that allowed about licensure denial was a little too broad, so the committee now has before them the -2 amendment, which removes language which allowed the board to deny licensure for any act or conduct derogatory to the practice of chiropractic or chiropractic assistance that would cause a reasonable person to doubt a practitioner's ability to safely treat a patient. It replaces this with language that would allow the board to deny licensure for an act or conduct that results in a judgment of wrongdoing by a court or administrative proceeding that is rationally connected to the ability to practice chiropractic or chiropractic assistance.
Okay. discussion. Okay, seeing no discussion. We're in a work session.
We're in a work session. Okay. I move the dash two amendment to House Bill 2242.
Senator Cruz moves the dash two amendment to House Bill 2242. Discussion. Seeing no discussion, so moved.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2242 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2242 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing no discussion, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Monica Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator York?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Morissette?
Aye.
House Bill 2242 moves the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Anybody want to carry this bill?
I want to carry the last one, not this
one. Oh, you want to carry the last one.
You can carry this one.
Would you carry this one?
Mm-mm.
Okay, I'll carry this one. Okay, I will carry the bill. Okay, we are going to hear. We're going to move the order just to... No, we're not going to move the order. We're going to open the public hearing on HDR 51. Oh, is that the one? Okay. Sarah?
Thank you, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here with you today. My name is Representative Sarah Gelser, and I represent House District 16, which includes the portions of Benton County that are Corvallis and Philomath. And I also have the privilege of representing two individuals who live in Linn County in the same house. HDR 51 comes to you from the House. It moved through our Human Services and Women's Wellness Committee in the House of Representatives, where it passed out of committee on a unanimous vote. It received 44 votes on the floor of the House. And it's essentially a values statement about what we do with dollars that we're currently spending on developmental disability services. Right now, as you probably know, we have over 9,000 Oregonians with developmental disabilities who are eligible for services who are waiting to receive them. We also have several thousand children with developmental disabilities who are not receiving any supports at all, even though they would be eligible and have very significant disabilities. There are a couple of changes that are happening in our care model in the state of Oregon in regards to people with developmental disabilities right now. The first is that the Department of Human Services is rewriting its rules in regards to the admission of people with developmental disabilities into nursing homes. As you probably know, federal law does not allow individuals with DD or with mental illness to be placed into nursing homes simply because they have a developmental disability. Unfortunately, we have about 60 Oregon children who are growing up in nursing homes. And just as a point of reference, the average length of stay for a senior living in a nursing home in Oregon right now is just under 3 months. For these children, it's just over 7 years, and their average age is 9 years old. These are children that are there because they have developmental disabilities. The Department of Human Services is rewriting their rules to make sure that door is better safeguarded for kids coming in. As a result, some of the nursing homes that are serving kids are going to be closing some of those beds. That's going to result in some savings in the system. A nursing home bed for a child costs approximately $264 per child per day just for the bed. That's before you provide any medical services. So obviously, even the closure of 10 beds provide some savings in that developmental disability system. And there's an interest among advocates in being sure that when that happens, those dollars are spent on supporting those very disabled children in the community and in their families' homes. At the time that this bill was drafted, we were still under the governor's proposed budget. And in the governor's proposed budget, he had recommended the closure of Eastern Oregon Training Center, with all residents leaving the Eastern Oregon Training Center by April 1st of 2008. In that, by the time individuals had moved into the community, there was a savings identified in the first biennium of about $1 million. The governor's budget did not preserve that $1 million in the human services budget or the developmental disabilities budget. It was essentially a cut. So part of the desire of this bill was to say that when and if the closure of Eastern Oregon Training Center happens, just like when Fairview happened, those dollars should remain in the developmental disability services to develop community-based supports for those 9,000 individuals who are not yet receiving supports.
Mr. Chairman, yes. Representative, I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but I'm going to need to leave right now, and I'd love to be recorded as a yes vote on this. Can we do that in advance of your vote? if I need to leave?
I can talk much faster and wrap up. Okay. I like that response.
Okay, we can. You're going to have to leave right now.
I have a dental appointment.
Okay.
They want to give you my
feedback. Close the public hearing and open a work session. Would you move the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move House Joint Resolution 51 and Gross be adopted and move the Senate floor with the due pass as adopted.
Yeah, we do have an amendment.
Mr. Chair,
it's already amended.
Okay. Senator Cruz moved H.J.R. 51A. It's already been amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Those in favor? Would you please call the roll?
Senator Berger? Mr. Chair, I did not have my questions answered.
Excuse me. Okay. Would you just like to record
sorry
your
about
vote?
That.
Could I do that right now? And then? Okay, great. Well, of course, it's aye.
Okay. Senator Jordan is an aye. I will reopen the public hearing, and we're going to continue hearing. And
I don't think you can do that. But we're still in work session.
Okay, we're in work session. Continue, and would you please
answer
the... I'm sorry. What was your question?
Well, my question is that it seemed to me that the budget request that came was because of a savings, and there were only 50 people. And the bill says that you would like an economic development plan for the city of Pendleton, which is a little bit different than what I heard you say about Fairview and the money going. Is it the same as the Fairview money going, that it would go to the city of Pendleton for services to the people that had moved out of the Eastern Oregon Center?
I'm really glad you asked that question, and that's where I was going next in the presentation. That was an amendment that was made on the House side because the issue was raised that the issue at the Eastern Oregon Training Center is certainly a very complicated one. We are serving 39 people at a cost of $244,000, $288,000 per person per year, and moving to a community-based system would clearly produce some savings, but it's a very difficult economic question for Pendleton. So what this was saying is that when that closes, the state needs to pay attention through its economic development funds to the issues in Pendleton. So at the time that Eastern Oregon Training Center closes, we do have a responsibility as a state to look at the issues in Pendleton that come from changing systems of state government. It's not intended to say that the human service dollars would go towards economic development there, but that in concert, if the institution is to close, that we cannot do that without recognizing that there's an economic impact to Pendleton.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Yes.
I could. I think that's an interesting add to the bill, but the main... Well, and this is a resolution. It's just a request. It doesn't have the force of law. But you know, the fact is that it's saying that if there are funds in for DD services and there are savings in DD services, those dollars should still be sequestered and used for DD services, and that's the main thrust of it. The fact that there will be an impact on the city of Pendleton with the closure is certainly something that needs to be looked at, and it's a separate request as drafted in the bill. But it has nothing to do with requesting that the DD dollars stay in DD, as I read the bill.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
In that regard, I am not sure that they're keeping that facility open for the right reason. If it's for the welfare of Pendleton, it should be for the welfare of the children, not the welfare of Pendleton.
Mr. Chair, I agree with you exactly.
And that is my comment for the record. I think it's okay. Other questions? Did you have other?
That pretty much sums it up. I hope I answered your question, Senator Berger.
Okay. It did. Mr. Chairman, yeah. I just want to support what you just said. I think that's what I'm trying to get at, is that the closure is for savings and for the betterment of the children there and not for the economic development of any city, not just Pendleton. Right.
And, Mr. Chair, I would just, for the record, it's actually 39 adults that are there.
Mr. Chair, I'd just say, and I agree with what Senator Berger just said, and I think that the fate of the facility is not dependent upon the city of Pendleton. It's dependent upon on services to the people in the facility. Clearly, I think there, long term, there is a more economical way to deliver those services, and it would allow us to spread the dollars for services to more people. And I think that's what the resolution speaks to, is basically we're moving in that direction. Let's make sure that the dollars don't get frittered off on something else.
Okay. I believe that my name was called, Mr. Chair.
Yes, it was.
And then I'll give it an aye vote.
This is rather disjointed work session.
It is, but it's fine.
Catherine, did you have anything to add to that? Okay, good. Okay. Would you continue calling the roll?
Senator Berger.
Aye.
Senator George.
Aye.
I thought you were leaving.
Well, I'm worried. I'm going to ask a question in a minute.
Senator Bonnie Anderson.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Cruz. Aye.
Aye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bill passes. Do pass recommendation.
Who's carrying it?
If I had known you were going to stay around, I wouldn't have had this disjointed.
Very important issue. Can I ask you a question real quick?
Yes.
I understand there's a...
We can carry it over if we need to.
I think we're okay.
Are
you okay? Yeah, thank you.
Maybe.
I will promise to drive with
you.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you have to
carry? I will. 3328. Oh, we're not going to do the other one.
No, this is just Representative Gelser's other bill.
Oh, Representative Gelser is still here. Okay, we will open a public hearing on 3328. Representative Gelser, you're up again.
And Mr. Chair, may I bring one of the first witnesses with me?
Yes.
To open the panel. Thank you. This is Joan Demarest.
Welcome, Joan.
Thank you. Putting away my other bill file and locating the appropriate one.
When you're ready.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state representative from Corvallis and Philomath, House District 16. And I'm here to talk to you today about the kind of bill that no one ever wants to bring on behalf of a constituent. And this is a bill about child abuse investigations. Although it's based on a situation that happened in my community about 2 years ago with the death of a 3-year-old child named Carly Sheehan, which is why the bill is referred to as Carly's Law, it is really about some of the weaknesses in our child abuse investigation system across the state of Oregon. What this bill would do is bring consistency to the investigation of physical abuse cases when children present to authorities in the course of a child abuse investigation with suspicious physical injuries. And I'll talk with you a little bit more later about what those are. You're going to receive a number of materials today. I will walk you through the pictures in a little bit. David Sheehan, who is Carly's father, testified on the House side, is not able to be here today, but in the materials that you're receiving is his written testimony, as well as the testimony of Dr. Carol Shervinak, who is a child abuse physician who specializes in doing child abuse medical assessments. But before I walk you through the entirety of the bill, I'd like to give you an introduction to what brought my attention to this, which is the case of Carly Sheehan. And to do that today, to talk a little bit about the legal issues and how these holes in the system were uncovered, we have Joan Demarest, who is the deputy district attorney that prosecuted this case. She's going to walk you through the specifics of Carly's case, the issues that arose from that, and after that, I will walk you through the bill and explain to you why this is applicable to children all across the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Joan Demarest. I started prosecuting cases for the Benton County District Attorney's Office over 10 years ago, and last case I did prosecute this case. Sean Wesley Field was convicted of murder and torture of Carly Sheehan, and he'll be in prison for the next 45 years or so. In the current child abuse framework, we have layers and layers of safeguards to protect children. Carly slipped through every single layer that we have in place. This legislation that's proposed will close the gaps and prevent more children like Carly from being murdered under our watch.
Okay. In the mid-90s, when I was mayor of Springfield, Tesla Noko, a three-year-old, was murdered by her mother's boyfriend. My wife and I sat through that trial. Judge Valour presided. And the person who perpetrated the crime was sentenced to the same sentence, murder, and 40, 50 years in prison. As a result of that, we did work on the safety net because she slipped through the cracks, and we didn't think it would ever happen again, and it did. And so obviously there's still cracks there that people slip through, and I think it is absolutely atrocious that this happened again, and we don't want it to happen in the future. So hopefully we do have a better handle on it. Service to Children and Families did investigate. They didn't do a thorough investigation. The local police did not report it. What their findings were, there were several problems along the way, but a three-year-old child was tortured to death over the course of a year or so. Okay, continue.
Okay, thank you. And that's very similar to this case. In this case, law enforcement, DHS, Carly's physician, and the Benton County Child Abuse Response Team, which is made up of court-appointed special advocates, members of DHS, members of our local child abuse, ABC House, Child Advocacy Center, the District Attorney's Office, and three different agencies of law enforcement, and members of the Juvenile Department all sit on this team. And this team staffed Carly's case twice, about 6 months before she was murdered. So I'd like to just give you a quick nutshell of the timeline. The defendant came into Carly's life in September 2004. He was Carly's mother's boyfriend. Not long after he came into her life, her behavior significantly changed, and she was missing hair. On November 17, 2004, Carly's daycare provider, who is a mandatory reporter, called DHS and made a report about her concerns. At that time, DHS opened an investigation. They met with Carly and her parents at Carly's physician's office. The Corvallis Police Department became involved with a special trained child abuse detective on the case, and the case was staffed by the Benton County Child Abuse Response Team. At that time, the defendant was telling people that Carly was pulling her own hair out and hitting herself. At that time, all of the aforementioned parties concluded that Carly was doing this to herself, and nobody at that time took any pictures to document Carly's appearance except for Carly's father. So that was November 17th, and the investigation continued from there. Just when they were about to close the investigation, on Saturday, December 11th, Carly was returned after a week visitation with her mother at her mother's boyfriend's house, looking horrible. Most of her hair at that time was missing. There were bruises about her head and her face, and she was exhausted, and clinging to her father would not let him let go of her. That night, Corvallis Police Department responded and observed Carly, did not take any photographs of her. Those are the sleeping child photograph that you have in front of her is a photograph that her father took that night around the same time the police department was there. The father forwarded those photographs to DHS. Those photographs were lost and never shown to anybody never shown to Dr. Carol Shervinek, who's our local child abuse expert physician who does all the evaluations at our local advocacy center. Even after viewing Carly, the law enforcement went and talked to the defendant, who again said that Carly was doing this to herself. A trained child abuse doctor seeing those photographs would not make the same conclusion, would not say that that was consistent. A child does not have the strength to inflict the kind of injuries you see in those pictures. However, the child's doctor, who saw her again 2 days later, concluded that those injuries were consistent with self-inflicted wounds. That's her primary care physician. As a result of the defendant's statements, the Corvallis Police Department closed that report with the injuries that you see photographed there as unfounded, concluding that the injuries had been self-inflicted. DHS closed the case shortly thereafter. They decided that the stress of the new boyfriend was what was causing Carly to act out against herself in this way, and they closed the case after everybody agreed that she wouldn't be exposed to the boyfriend anymore. The boyfriend beat Carly to death about 6 months later. I firmly believe that if this bill had been in place in 2004, it would have caused photographs to have been taken and not lost by the authorities, and it would have caused those photographs to be reviewed by the child abuse doctor, this trained child abuse doctor, not just any physician, but the trained child abuse doctor, and Carly would not have slipped through the cracks, and she'd be with us today. I'd like to mention that ODAA is in support of this bill, and I think that there's been some discussion about some of the terminology in the bill. The definition of physical injury that's in the bill is different from it. There's a specific list of injuries to look for that would trigger the requirements of this bill. And I know that there's been some discussion about that. I've provided in my testimony the statutory definitions of physical injury and serious physical injury, and I'd like to point out that if this bill only triggered the photographs and the review and the cases of serious physical injury, we wouldn't see any improvement in the system. As a prosecutor for 10 years, I encountered cases of serious physical injury very rarely. Serious physical injury is defined as physical injury which creates a substantial risk of death or which causes serious and protracted disfigurement, protracted impairment of health, or protracted loss or impairment of the function of any bodily organ. It's a very high threshold to meet. Someone covered head to toe in bruises would not meet this definition. I, as a prosecutor, actually tried, because skin is a bodily organ, I tried to submit a case as serious physical injury when somebody had a scar on their skin, and the judge would not buy it. Even in some cases involving knife wounds or gunshot wounds would not qualify as serious physical injury. In Carly's case, she had bruises and she had hair loss, and that's all she had. But it would have been clear to a trained medical provider that those could not have been self-inflicted and that the adequate intervention would have been made at the time. So it's my belief that the current language in the bill is what needs to stay, and it's what will make a difference in preventing this from happening again. And I'd also like to say that as a prosecutor, there has been a concern at the previous committee that that this was just a response to this one case. I can say that more times than not, as a prosecutor, I lamented the fact that there were not photographs accompanying a case submitted for review, a case of abuse. For one reason or another, sometimes the agency can't afford the equipment, or the equipment is malfunctioning, but more often than not, we receive cases where there's physical injury and it's not documented by photographs. So this is not an isolated occurrence. In fact, our local GT reporter rode around with DHS while she was doing some background work on this case, and the DHS worker did have a camera but did not have the memory chip for the camera, so it was essentially useless. So this is a serious issue that is prevalent, and I do ask that you vote for this bill. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, if it would be acceptable to you, I'd like to walk you through the provisions of the bill now that you kind of know the background of it.
Yeah.
Is that okay? Thank you. Joan referenced this issue of the definition of injury, and this is important to this bill because what it essentially does is removes from law enforcement and the CPS worker the responsibility to make a medical diagnosis. It says when there's a medical problem, we're going to let a medical professional take care of that. And for the purposes of this bill, a medical professional includes a physician, a nurse practitioner, or a physician's assistant. We kept that very broad because we recognize that we have children in more rural areas where it might be very difficult to access a doctor. What we wanted to do was to, and this bill came together from the work of a lot of people. We had the Department of Justice at the table. We had DHS, the Juvenile Rights Project. We had the assessment centers. We had physicians. We had law enforcement. We had all sorts of people there with eyes on. So it's gone through many, many iterations to get to the point where it passed off the floor of the House unanimously last week. But the goal was to be sure that in the course of a child abuse investigation, so someone is called, they've made an allegation of abuse, and it's one of those 40% of the cases where someone goes out to investigate it. The first responder gets there to the child and finds that the child is injured. That's what triggers the steps that I'm going to go through in the bill. Because it's triggered by the injury, we had to define what the injury was. Physical injury didn't work because it's very broad. A child can't, especially a small child, most victims of physical abuse are young children under the age of 5. They can't really describe what significant pain is. It also, we wanted to be careful that we weren't picking up every kid that fell off their bicycle or slid into third base, which is why, again, it has to be in the context of a child abuse investigation. So what we came up with was this phrase that we're calling suspicious physical injury. And this includes, but is not limited to, burns or scalds, extensive bruising or abrasions on any part of the body, bruising, swelling, or abrasions on the head, neck, or face, fractures of any bone in a child under the age of 3, multiple fractures in a child of any age, dislocations, soft tissue swelling, or moderate to severe cuts, loss of the ability to walk or move normally according to the child's developmental ability, unconsciousness, or difficulty maintaining consciousness, and it goes on. I've got an amendment to talk to you about a little bit later. And all of this is linked to the reasonable suspicion that this injury may be the result of abuse. The purpose of having a list there was to help trigger for those first responders the kinds of injuries that really might tip someone off that this child is in danger, that there has been inflicted abuse. And then to help that person say, we need to get this child to a doctor to determine whether or not it has been inflicted. If the child is found to have a suspicious physical injury, two things will happen as a result of that under this bill. The first is that the visible injuries will be photographed. Those, and the bill lays out the protocols for what happens to those photographs. Hard copies of the photographs go into the child's file. They'll be shared with a child abuse assessment professional, and they'll be shared with the members of the child abuse multidisciplinary team that might be staffing the case. The second thing that's going to happen is that within 48 hours, that child is going to be taken to a designated medical professional or a medical professional that has expressed an interest and an expertise in understanding and diagnosing child abuse injuries. This does not have to be the Child Abuse Assessment Center in each community. What will happen is each multidisciplinary team, later on in the bill in another section, each multidisciplinary team is going to identify its panel of medical professionals that are willing and able to be a resource to the multidisciplinary team as they're going through these assessments. So it could be that a local pediatrician steps up and says, this is an area of interest and concern for me. I want to be this person for you, or a nurse practitioner. There can be several of them. So a side effect of this bill is going to be that the MDTs are going to better know who the medical resources are in the community that they have that are interested in this area, that are willing to share their expertise. If one of these individuals isn't available within 48 hours, the bill says that's okay. The child will see a medical professional. They'll get to some medical professional, and that medical professional, through photographs and telephone, will consult with someone with some expertise in child abuse. The bill also states that when that happens, this physician is evaluating, it prompts them to refer the child for early intervention, early childhood special ed services if they're under the age of 5 and there appear to be developmental concerns, which is a way of pulling in an existing resource that can wrap around the child. The bill is very careful to indicate that if the child has a very serious injury that needs immediate medical attention, the most important thing is getting that child the medical attention they need from whoever it might be that can provide that to them. In Section 4 of the bill, it states that anytime there is a fatality, a child fatality of a child known to the agency, as was Carly, that the new critical incident response team protocol will be triggered. This was not triggered in Carly's case. This was designed to have a review of the systems in a case to be able to look back and see what went well and where we might learn from failings in the system to be able to improve it. One of the benefits of putting this in statute and triggering it every time that there's a fatality is really to protect the workers in many ways from picking and choosing which ones we go back to look at. Any fatality is a bad outcome. We need to be able to go back and look at those outcomes and the processes that led to them candidly and openly and not in a witch hunt kind of atmosphere. So this will just be triggered. The bill in Section 5, in terms of the photographs, makes a clarification. Currently, under DHS rules, a child abuse investigator, DHS employee can take photographs of a child, including of their anal and genital region, as long as they're not touching the child. This bill indicates that really those kinds of photographs should be taken by a medical professional. Those are the only people that should be taking those photographs, and people liked those. Again, it talks about issues around the storage of the photos so that the photos are not lost. If you move on in Section 6, all the way to the end on the bottom of page 4, this is where it talks about each county multidisciplinary team designating at least one, but it could be many, physician, physician assistant, or nurse practitioners who have been trained to conduct child abuse medical assessments. So again, this is that panel of people that is going to be willing to provide this type of support and examination, understanding of a bruise on the head of an infant is not a common thing. They don't slip in the bathtub. That's something to be very concerned about, is the testimony we received from Dr. Chervenek last time.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
if I could.
Mm-hmm.
How many physician assistants or nurse practitioners with this specific type of training are currently residing in Harney County?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I got hung up on the representative House thing. It's new to be over here. I do not know the answer to that question. However, the point of making this very broad, and we have not defined exactly what that training and an assessment is for the purpose of making sure that this is not inaccessible to the rural areas. The other thing that's in the bill, if you move forward to subsection 11, by September 1st of 2008, each county is going to submit to the Department of Justice a progress report on the implementation of this law. The point of this is to identify, my guess is this is going to come primarily from the rural counties, what the barriers are to making this happen. Is it an issue of recruitment of medical personnel? Do they have people that are willing to do it but they don't have training? What would the financial resources be necessary to make that happen? So what's built into the bill is that safeguard that says, let's go after this, let's implement this law, let's come back and see what's not working in the interim so that in our next legislature we can look at what kind of resources have we committed and are we committing the appropriate resources to help people do their jobs to protect these individuals wherever they live in the state, whether it's Harney County or Multnomah County. Kids that are hurt need medical care.
Go ahead.
Just follow. I understand what you're driving for, and in Marion County or Washington County, it's probably not so much an issue, but I guess one of the things I'm looking at is the fact that we are having, in rural Oregon, having difficulty finding medical providers of any kind. And just when I was reading the language here, you're kind of driving towards this, from my perspective, first goal is providing access to health care, mm-hmm. big picture, and getting those providers there, and then we're trying to drive to another thing, and I just want to make sure we're not setting up something that would be incredibly difficult to achieve in all 36 counties. So,
right. Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, that is a discussion that we had a lot in these work groups, and it's certainly a concern that I share. One of the reasons that we defined so broadly the medical professional and did not define what that training is, by stepping forward and having a person identified, they are, by virtue of that interest, going to have a heightened awareness of these issues. They're going to be looking for that information. They also will be able to, the bill doesn't say that the practitioner has to reside in or practice in that county as well. So it could be someone in a rural county is consulting with an assessment center someplace else or a pediatrician at OHSU. There's a whole variety of ways that this can be put together. The goal here really is many of these kids, when you've got broken bones, when you've got burns, when you've got lacerations, these kids are already getting medical treatment for those injuries, but it's happening outside of the context of the child abuse investigation. That's certainly what happened with Carly. What this will do, even in the rural areas, is bring all of that information together, again, so that the physician studying the injury knows the context that the injuries are coming in, and that law enforcement officer or that child protective services worker isn't having to make that diagnosis. It improves the communication between the many parts of the team.
Do you have emergency first responder in here?
What we refer to, because of the way that this is set up and this happens in the context of a child abuse investigation, this is not someone going out to a meth house bust or a domestic violence situation at a home. This is an allegation of child abuse has been made. Okay. This is in the context of a child abuse investigation. So it's going to be a CPS worker or a law enforcement officer or both going out together.
Maybe too late. What I'm getting at is I think that this should be something that all emergency first responders are aware of, and if they feel. Now, the other flip side is, what sanctions are there if a person doesn't do what they're supposed to? This is a huge, complicated undertaking. And it just seems to me that any emergency responder that goes out in anywhere in the state of Oregon ought to be aware of this. I don't know if emergency responders carry a camera with them, but if they're going to go, if the child is really hurt, they're going to take them to an emergency room somewhere. And the child abuse part of it may come in later, but I mean, the first obligation is to protect the child from when the child is seriously injured, and be sure there's the evidence. It's a crime has been committed, and the evidence cannot be destroyed. It needs to be preserved. And so, I mean, what sanctions are there if we pass this bill out of here and it's not complete? Are there sanctions involved?
Mr. Chair, there are no sanctions that are written into this bill, except for that clearly it heightens the professional responsibility of the individuals that are responding. In terms of the first responders, the emergency medical technicians, they are mandatory reporters of abuse. So they will make a report which will trigger this whole process to start again. So that investigation would start. Probably then coming to the hospital would be a law enforcement officer or CPS worker. The photographs would be taken. It would trigger that whole cycle.
Good. That's what I wasn't sure about. And then the sanctions, if somebody doesn't pick up on it, I mean, there are no sanctions as such, right? Or are there?
There are no sanctions written into this bill.
Okay. Yes, Senator Virgil.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What happened in the case of Carly to the mother?
I'm going to let Joan answer that question. I think that one of the issues that this raised also in our community is the impact of domestic abuse and manipulation of women by individuals. And I believe that Sarah is here today, Carly's mother. I know that Carly's grandfather is here as well. Joan?
I think Sarah Sheen may have been tied up in her route here from Bend, as she was expected. In this case, the defendant engaged in some very sophisticated yet common methods of domestic abuse and essentially brainwashed the mother into believing that Carly was in fact self-inflicting the injuries that she suffered. When the report came to DHS in November and then December of 2004, she had not only her boyfriend telling her that this was happening, but she also had law enforcement, DHS, and her physician all telling her, yes, these injuries are self-inflicted. All these people who should be experts in this field and who should be able to tell if, in fact, that is true. But one of the things that I put in my written testimony and omitted from my spoken testimony was that the only other area that I feel this case brought to light that we need more work in is in the area of domestic abuse. There wasn't very much physical violence in that relationship. However, the domestic abuse that is most effective is verbal, psychological, financial abuse and control that abusers inflict on their victims, and they're able to be quite successful at manipulation with those methods, excluding any physical violence. And so I would also urge this committee to support increased funding in domestic abuse programs, and to just realize that domestic abuse is much more than just domestic violence. It can be a very abusive relationship without any physical injury inflicted on the woman. It was our conclusion in the DA's office that she was not criminally responsible in any way for this. She also was a victim in this case.
And Mr.
I have a follow-up. Why did you not include self-inflicted in physical? In other words, the self-infliction that is to the point of pulling all hair out and so forth would indicate certainly a negative emotional environment of some kind. And so that was physical abuse, but it was inflicted by the individual. However, extreme self-inflicted abuse would, in my opinion, fall under some of the categories that you did list.
Chair Morissette, Senator Verger, in the original form of the original version of the bill, it had a section about when the injuries are suspected to be self-inflicted, and part of that was the indication, if you look at those photos, whatever was happening, this was clearly a child that needed help, and we had an obligation to help her. The physicians that specialize in child abuse, the MDT team folks that came together, the Department of Justice, were very, very concerned about including self-inflicted injury in the bill, because that is so rare as to be nearly non-existent in child abuse cases, and they were concerned that including it in statute would give the idea that children would self-inflict injuries greater credibility than it deserved and could actually undermine efforts to help children by including that language. In this case, what happens is we're not asking that first responder to determine the source of the injury. We're going to take them to a doctor who is going to be able to determine that. The other thing that's important, given your previous question, is that often these children are under the age of 5, usually under the age of 3, and are unable to speak for themselves, often for whatever reason, whether it's gross negligence on the part of the caretaker, if it's domestic abuse, for some reason, the people that are responsible for them, their caretakers, either cannot or will not speak for them. And these injuries can speak a lot about what's happening to them, and that's why it's so important to get them to this place that's often not their own family doctor, to get them out of that environment so their injuries can tell the story and the kids can hopefully find some safety if they are being abused.
Go ahead.
One more last follow-up, Mr. Chair. What happens in the department when photos are lost?
I believe the department is here. And
well, I can ask them that question if they are.
Patty, would you come up, please?
No.
Different departments. Okay.
Same department, different people.
Okay. Go ahead and introduce yourself, please.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Una Swanson, and I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for the Department of Human Services. And the question was, what would the department do if photos are lost?
What does the department do when photos of an extreme importance such as this are lost?
Chair Morissette, Senator Verger, a couple of issues related to this case, and I don't have the details in front of me, so I'd like you to know that I'm speaking somewhat from memory. One of the pieces of film related to this case, there was a break-in in the office and there was a camera stolen, and so that is one of the ways in which film was lost, but I can't speak to exactly the circumstances. Is that correct? Am I speaking correctly?
If I could respond, they did have a break-in and a camera was stolen. It was not concluded that was the same camera on which the photos were taken.
Okay. Chair Morissette and Senator Berger, it's not an issue that comes up often, but certainly this case and working with Representative Gelser has caused me as a program manager to survey the camera equipment that we have in each office, the ability to copy film, and to review with each office the protocols around the storage of the film. One of the things that's happened with the implementation of digital photography, I don't know if you have a camera at home, but we tend to be less efficient about getting hard copies of the film because they're stored on a disk, and we continue to have a protocol now in which the film will be stored in the file, marked, and also have what will be available to the assessment centers, which would be a film on disks, which would be good for them. So I don't know if that speaks exactly to your question, but certainly it's a concern to us if film is lost and we do everything under our control to retrieve it and to see that it didn't happen again.
May I respond, yes, Mr. Chair? Let me just say that of all the jobs that I can think of in a list, you have probably one of the most responsible jobs. Today, we have too many children that are not being treated as they should be. And I don't know exactly what the answer is to that, but I applaud you for the work that you do every day. And it's a hard job, and it's a job that is causes lots of anxiety and anguish, I'm sure, on your part. You look like a person that would be very kind to children. But I do hope that that in your department there is a kind of revitalized effort on the part of children that we take, all of us should take an oath to be better protectors of our little people in this country.
Chair Morissette and Senator Berger, thank you for your comments. And we certainly, this topic and the discussion of this case has certainly caused us to look much closer at all of our practices in this area.
Mr. Chair, there was one final piece of the bill. At the very end of the bill, two more, the emergency clause. As mentioned previously, by October 1st of 2008, the Department of Justice will report back to an interim committee of the legislature the progress on implementing Carley's Law, as well as recommendations they have for making it possible to complete it. And it also provides that upon the conclusion of a criminal case involving a child fatality, the district attorney prosecuting that homicide case at the conclusion of that case may submit a letter to the Department of Human Services and the governor regarding suggestions or observations that they made about the system in the process. It's permissive language. Certainly right now, a district attorney would be allowed to do that, and talking with Scott Heiser, who was the Benton County district attorney at the time, he argued that this language would give him the ability to do that without stepping on toes or being inappropriate. And finally, there is an emergency act, an emergency clause for this bill saying that it will take effect upon its passage. Obviously, there is a lot of training that goes into this, and into effect, the department understands that means to begin the training for the MDTs to start bringing their trained providers online that people are going to, but the expectation isn't that if you move this bill out of committee today and the governor signs it 2 weeks from now, that the very next day all of these things will happen. We recognize that immediately the process for training will start, and hopefully shortly thereafter kids will start getting to the doctor. Finally, Joan mentioned that the Oregon District Attorney's Association is a supportive of this bill, as is the Juvenile Rights Project, who I believe is here today in order to testify, Children's First for Oregon. And I wanted to thank the Department of Human Services for being very supportive and helpful in the development of this bill over the course of a very long process. The Department of Justice was also very helpful and supportive. And the last thing that I wanted to mention is that we've got a lot of kids out there that need help, and we're not getting to them. And some of these are kids that are being unsubstantiated for abuse. Last night, a couple of days ago, an article about this bill ran in the Bend Bulletin, and as a result, on my campaign email account, someone had gone to my webpage, I got a letter from a 15-year-old who stated that in her family they're experiencing physical abuse and nobody would believe them. Needed to be able to see a doctor. I think that it's important that we give these kids a voice, get them to where they need to be. I think there certainly will be challenges in the implementation, but as one of the assessment centers said, We know that this could create increase our workload. It could make things difficult, but we know these kids are out there. We need to serve them. They're waiting for us to help them. And with that, I'll stay around after others testify. I would love the chance to conclude or answer any questions that come as a result of that, but I hope very much you'll move to work session and move this bill to the floor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cortland Geyer.
Welcome. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you. My name is Cortland Geyer. I'm a deputy district attorney with the Marion County District Attorney's Office, and I've been a child abuse prosecutor there for over a decade. I'm also the co-chair of the Marion County Multidisciplinary Child Abuse Team, the MDT, and you've just heard a lot of testimony about what they are and what they do. Forgive me if I jump around a little. I have been modifying my testimony as I've sat here and listened to some of the testimony offered. The money question, I guess, is as I'm here, am I for or against the bill? And unfortunately, it's not quite as simple as that. I am completely for the protection of children and for most of the principles that are adopted. I recognize that I am getting into this a little bit late, and it may be exceedingly unfair to Representative Gelsar. But as my MDT has been working on this just in the last 2 months, we have had some concerns about the language. And so here is my purpose here today. I am here because the bill certainly contemplates potential revisions or gathering information about the ability of people around the state to comply with the mandates of the bill beginning in 2008. I am here to lay seeds for some of that, and also, as you know, when we go about trying to apply the law and comply with the law, we look both to the plain text and to the intent of the legislature. So I'm here to offer some testimony my hope that I have a clear understanding of what the intent of the legislature is if and when you pass this out of committee.
Okay. As I was listening to the testimony, I was trying to think in my own mind what I would say if I carried this bill on the floor and what people might ask me about the implementation, because it is fairly complicated. Now, I already asked if there were sanctions. There are no sanctions. So this bill... Now, will your testimony deal with whether or not this bill should be introduced as is this session, or are you anticipating problems that will come up and could be solved later?
You get right to the heart of the matter, don't you, Chair Morissette? Sir, there are... Well, let me couch it this way. I have some concerns with the language as I see it. But having heard the testimony that was proffered here, I believe that the interpretation given to the language would not be the problem that causes concern for the multidisciplinary team that I represent. Our concerns are chiefly the scope of the bill and potential liability. And in your question, you mentioned the answer to the question, or else what, if you can't comply with the bill. But if I may address, sir, my concerns and then my understanding of what the representative's intent behind some of the language is, and my professed hope that it is intent behind the language that this committee adopts. Looking at the scope of the bill, there are a number of examples that have been pointed out of what constitutes suspicious physical injury as defined in the bill. I have no problem with those. All of the things that are set forth in the bill should be happening when a child abuse investigator is looking at any of those cases. However, when you take just the first sentence and the last sentence, sub K of that, what you're left with is a definition that requires a medical evaluation within 48 hours for any child suspected to have suffered an abusive physical injury. Physical injury has its own legal definition, which is any injury causing substantial pain. I have heard clearly that the testimony is that they want this to be something below the legal requirement of serious physical injury, but something more than just plain physical injury. And again, if it is the intent of this legislature that that is the case, then my concerns about the scope of the bill are somewhat alleviated. Here in Marion County, there are approximately 300 to 350 child abuse medical evaluations that are done every year between our local assessment center and the emergency room. That's where the bulk of these are done. Most of these are done in child sexual abuse investigations. In addition to those 300 or so cases of child sexual abuse, my office reviews an additional 500 cases of child physical abuse. In Marion County, we average every year 1,000 cases of confirmed abuse or neglect and 1,000 children placed in foster care. Those are just the confirmed cases. The number of reports is significantly higher. I don't have that exact number, but somewhere in my memory I recall that it's typically about five times. If we are talking about something above and beyond mere physical injury, if that's the intent of this committee, and it sounds like that's what was proposed by the testimony here, then I think that this is something that that my county can comply with. Otherwise, if we're talking an additional 300% of medical evaluations, based on my communications with the pediatric community, with Salem Hospital Emergency Room and our local assessment center, there's simply not capacity for all of those if this is given the broadest definition possible. So that was the first thing that I wanted to address. The other was liability. Yes, okay. I'm sorry. Mr. Chair.
I'm thinking, how do you narrow the scope? You said the broadest definition. Is there... So what's your suggestion?
Mr. Chair, the phrase that causes me concern is section 3, sub B, sub K, where it says any other injury that threatens the physical well-being of the child. When we couple that with a reference to physical injury, the question is, are we talking about mere physical injury? Can it be argued that any abusive physical injury, given the likelihood that it will be repeated and revisited on the child, threatens the well-being of the child? As I sat here and listened to the testimony, it seemed to me that is not what they are talking about. They are talking about something that is significant, substantial, but less than the life-threatening type situations that are required by to show legally serious physical injury. That's a term of art. So, I believe that the proponent of the bill has a direction in mind with what she wishes this to apply to. And so it's my prayer here today that my testimony also, I guess, guide the committee to ensure that this is what we are meaning, something above and beyond mere physical injury, which would then get us into the kind of numbers that concern me.
Have you been involved in the discussions of the language of the bill?
I have not, Your Honor, and that's why I said that I must acknowledge
you're
there is an unfairness.
You're talking to a judge, and I'm not here. That's okay.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, sir, I apologize for that.
I guess my concern is, and I'm, you know, it's... Even carrying a simple bill on the floor that you think you really, really understand sometimes is very difficult when you look at all of the variables and so on and so forth. And so I'm really kind of looking at tightening some of the language, and even if it takes some amendments, I would feel comfortable with that. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me. I would be happy to assist you with...
Give us your...
Oh, yes. Again, this is Representative Sarah Gelser from Benton County, House District 16. I carried the bill on the floor, and I would be happy to talk with you about the kinds of questions that I received. I wanted to assure you that All of these things have been discussed. The ability to get to this definition of suspicious physical injury was very difficult because we had to balance the needs of the Department of Human Services, the needs of the district attorneys, the needs of Child Protective Services, and the needs of the child. This definition, and I do have some amendments here for you today, it was very carefully negotiated with a very large group of stakeholders. I did not receive, and I appreciate that he contacted me last Thursday with these concerns, but the Oregon District Attorneys Association does not share these concerns and has not indicated them. We talked about these issues on the House side. I do believe that this is a very good bill that is ready to go this time, and I believe that offline, if I had further opportunities to speak with the Marion County MDT, that they could come to also support this bill, as do most everyone else that's worked on it. There is no other opposition to this bill. Many, many people from every perspective have been involved and have determined that this is a common sense bill that makes sense, and it would be unfortunate to see it held up because of concerns raised at the last minute.
Well, okay, the concerns, I'm raising some concerns.
Okay.
And I'm not sure, well, obviously we don't have enough people here to pass the bill even if we wanted to. But I do have some concerns. It's, now, you've worked on it for a long time with a lot of people, and so you have resolved the concerns in your mind. Coming to a different chamber, though, where we have not had the background other than the bill itself, but when you get into the details of it, it does get somewhat complex. Did you have that?
Well, Mr. Chair, one of the things that I find very frustrating in government, and I think it frustrates the whole world that are not in government, and that is that we can wordsmith things to death, talk things to death, look at details while, you know, it's, I feel like we're Nero fiddling while Rome burns. I think it's a good bill. I think it's a common sense bill. I think that if they want to remove that any injury that threatens the well-being of the child, to remove one line, if that is so broad that it causes concern that they would be not suspicious injury, but the bill lays out that it would be suspicious injury, something that would be very serious. I have a represent a county that has one of the highest child abuse cases in Oregon, in Coos County. And you can look at the statistics. It is a, it's an epidemic. It is so serious. And we need to get something. We need to get more than this. But certainly I find this certainly common sense, and I strongly support the bill.
We're going to hear from Kevin Neely in just a moment, also from the District Attorney Association. But would you like to continue your testimony?
I will try and wrap it up.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other issue that I just wanted to briefly address was that of liability.
Okay.
When setting mandates, the question becomes, or else what? I think, actually, that if the scope of this were smaller, that there might be reason for some intent that there be personal liability for failure to comply with the mandates. But I hear the testimony of the representative saying it is not the intent and it is not part of this bill. And I would ask that that the legislative body, this committee, pass it with a clear understanding that it is not intended that there be any personal liability for a child abuse investigator or a medical practitioner who fails to comply to face that. The other part of the liability that I wanted to bring up, the you do this or else what, is I do have some fears that the bill will be used, as other legal requirements I have seen, in court to cross-examine the child abuse investigator in the course of the defense. And perhaps in 2008, 2009, my perfect vision of this bill would have some amendment down the road that it not be grounds for dismissing the case and, frankly, not be relevant in the introduction of any criminal case or be grounds for personal civil liability for the child abuse investigator. those are the concerns that I wanted to bring to the attention of this committee. I thank you very much for your time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and I do appreciate your comments. Kevin Neely, would you like to react?
Would you like me to leave, sir?
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm still thinking about this, and as I mentioned earlier, we went through this in Springfield, and it was the death of a child, much the same circumstances, and so I very, very much want this, something like this, to happen. I mean, we've got to put a stop to it. I guess I'm... There are a couple of things. The implementation, now there's a time period to put some of these things in place, and there are no sanctions, which I think was one of the things that I was kind of concerned about, is if somebody missed a beat, you know, you lose a photo, then what? You know, if it happens a second time, losing a photo is an independent action that takes place by different people. Okay, Kevin, give us your best shot.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Neely. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and I would preface my very brief remarks by noting that, as several before me have said, the District Attorneys Association does support this bill, and I think one of the things that Ms. Demarest said earlier, really, for the district attorneys, in many instances, they are having to operate without getting pictures, without getting those photographs, for whatever reason. It may be that they're lost. It may be that they were never taken in the first place. That's one of the features of this bill that the district attorneys do most value moving forward in facilitation of prosecution of those cases. At least that's what I've heard from my colleagues around the state. I would say that we, as Representative Gelser indicated earlier, the district attorneys, and apparently I didn't spread the net broadly enough, spent significant periods of time working on the specific language of the bill. We ultimately did decide that suspicious physical injury, I think it's safe to say that probably wouldn't have been the most ideal language that we would have used as the District Attorneys Association. But, again, after having significant discussions with all sorts of folks, as Representative Gelser has indicated, that's the definition that we finally landed on that we thought could most effectively meet the needs of each of the participants. And if you look at an MDT, there's a whole array of people that are involved in these discussions, from DHS to the district attorneys to local law enforcement. And at the end of the day, after significant discussion, we decided that language was the best language that we could possibly use to address all the needs of all the participants. So that's mostly what I wanted to add on behalf of the District Attorneys Association. We support the bill. Hope you move it forward. Again, I think we'll see how it plays out over the next 2 years. And the good news is I expect you'll come back in 2 years if it doesn't play out how we expect it to.
Okay. Question? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Let me assure you we will move the bill. Not now, though. And we'll come back. We'll have another hearing or work session, and we'll give you an opportunity to. Senator Bridger, your feelings again.
Mr. Chair, I believe that House Bill 3328 is one more effort to try to speak for those who are unable to speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, many of the cases of child abuse are happening because people feel powerful and are preying on the powerless. And if there's anything that gets to my heart quicker, mm-hmm. it's people who take advantage of others, regardless of their age, but who feel in a powerless position. I want to applaud the representative for bringing the bill forward and for the hard work in building consensus. It's obvious by the last testimony that we heard that she has included everyone at the table that wanted to be there, and that she has worked very hard to get the language so that people are all satisfied with it. And I want to commend her for that effort. That is a very long process, as you know, in bringing a bill this far. I would encourage the chair to pass the bill out. It does have an emergency clause, and as far as I'm concerned, the sooner the better.
Okay. We will do that, and when the time comes, Senator Berger will carry the bill, and I will speak for it. At this point, we're going to close the public hearing, and we will come back again. We'll carry this over until Wednesday, and we'll come back on Wednesday. And with that, we are going. We are also going to carry House Bill 2184 over until Wednesday, and with that, we are adjourned.